rest of us try and hide a bit. The advantage to a clinical department is one's not quite under the same pressure for a tenure decision that you're under in the basic science departments.
Because you can run on, can you run on indefinitely without tenure, or how does it work?
Well, no, not really. There's a lot more flexibility.
Just more years?
Yeah. Basically, there is at least 6 years after they make you an associate professor, and that can take a while. So you can easily be unemployed at 50. No, I would like to hang out in Boston and either see what happens or take a departmental chair and a tenure position at the same time. The advantage, you know, why do all that administrative stuff? The reason is the clinical revenues. The people with power these days have departments that generate clinical revenues. And you can take those revenues. Besides paying, compensating people well, you can develop scientific programs and support junior people.
And you really would have, as chair, a lot of discretion to generate.
Absolutely.
And
under the current health payback situation, which of course is subject to change, but yeah, those revenues basically come back to the department and the chair can allocate them as sees fit. That's the difference, for example, between Catran's position as chair of pathology at the Brigham, or the chair of pathology at NGH, for example, and the chair of pathology at Harvard. No clinical revenues, all administrative. It's a pain in the ass. Yes, you have space, but you don't have the same kind of funds.
Does that mean the Harvard department, in fact, gets less prestigious people, or is there enough just name to...
Well, no. I mean, there are people who for example, were well-established people who have turned down the chair at Harvard of pathology because of that problem. They're better off being in a clinical context, or they don't want to move to Boston and deal with all the clinical nightmares. It's interesting. The chair has been turned down several times. I'm trying to think whether any, I don't think any of the national academy, or the advisory board's turned it down. Bill Paul may have been asked, I don't know. The current chair is Baruch Benassareff, and he's resigned the position as chair of pathology to he had two positions, chair of pathology and director of research at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's relinquished the former, and the search committee was formed, and so on and so forth.
Let me go back into inside your career, if we may, for a little while. And you're 86. You're setting up your own lab, essentially. Is that right?
Right.
How has that lab grown and changed over time? What is it now? What do you want it to be? Can you talk about the realities?
Well, the reality, I had, as I mentioned, sort of elbow the technicians out of there. They're tenured technicians, basically, who could be a pain in the ass. But I didn't get any startup funds because the chair, Ramsey's a brilliant guy. He was born in Lebanon, speaks five languages. He knew that if I had a big R1, I can get anything I needed, so he wasn't going to give me much money. So I had to build it up. Every wastebasket, every chair, we had to purchase. It cost us a fair amount of time, but it is now... we've expanded a little bit, but started with one technician, and we're still a very small group. There's no graduate program in pathology. I depend on residents to try and recruit, and I've had some success with residents. For example, Art Mendoza was a GYN pathologist who wanted to do some things, learn a little science. He came in the lab and we tried to help him out. Current postdoc is Joachim Fries. He's an interesting story. He was basically fired from his first postdoc, which was renal pathology, and then went to this Harvard School of Public Health with Diane Wirth, where he was also fired. And he was on his way back to Germany, but he's very loud, he's very aggressive. But he's kind of manic depressive. When he's manic, he's incredibly good. So I figured, well, he's better than nothing. And recruiting people is very difficult. And he's turned out to be quite good.
Difficult, Dallas?
Well, it's difficult because why come to Boston and work with me when you can work with Phil Leader or David Baltimore or people who are more well-known? And we don't have a graduate program. The high-powered residents, the MD, PhDs, who have been well-trained, are candidates for the biggest labs in the city, so they wouldn't be interested in someone like me. Now, in contrast, if I were sitting in Rochester, I'd be mocked. I can tell you. There are enough interesting things going on in the lab for people to join. It's just that in Boston, you have such a wealth of such powerful people that the junior people can really struggle. I would say that's my biggest complaint, difficulty is getting people into the laboratory. I've been dependent on Jim Brony, for example, to have folks available to help fill the lab and do interesting things, like this guy, Myron Cebulski. Wanted to learn molecular biology. He was a good cell biologist and is now cloning an interesting molecule.
In terms of funding the lab and...
Okay. Funding the lab, as I mentioned, has been reasonably good. I've been very lucky. I wrote an R01 when I was a second-year resident, which was funded. And basically it was used to start up the laboratory and fund a technician. I'm almost entirely on... My salary is derived entirely from grant support. That's minus about 7 or 8%, which I get from the autopsy service work I do. So if I don't stay funded, I'm out the door. They wouldn't keep me. That's why I don't really worry about a tenure decision. Because nobody pays me anything. They don't pay me anything anyway. I do not have salary support.
Well, there are a lot of people around Boston in analogous position.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what, in a sense, makes it exciting. Even the more senior people are dependent on federal revenues for their salary support. They've gotten lazy, in a sense. They've been very lucky in terms of grant support. Usually been well funded. But times are changing, and even the more senior people are being cautious in their applications, applying early and making sure they have duplicate funding vehicles, trying to cut back, not waste, because it has, for the last few years, have been very tough. Anyway, so I wrote 1R01. Then Mike Gimbroni is a powerful guy, has a $3 million a year program project. I contributed a part of that program project. And then this winter I wrote another R01, which, believe it or not, got a priority score of 0.9. It was unbelievable. It was just staggering. And the percentage was very good. So it was funded, but it wasn't funded at a level that I would have liked. Even though the study section approved it all, there were mandatory fixed cuts in what they could provide. So even if you get through the scientific review process, the start date can be postponed, or council can change the funding amounts because of this and that. So that's why the Pew funds are so incredibly valuable. The Pew funds supported Freeze. They paid his salary. Very valuable guy. And they supported another individual, Parvez Sultan, who is an undergraduate in the laboratory, who has been productive.
Why did Harvard nominate you for the Pew?
Oh, that's an interesting story. Harvard didn't nominate me. Okay, my year, Roger Brent was nominated by Harvard. Harvard, as you know, has a very interesting system because they have these different schools. There's the medical school, the School of Public Health, and the School of Arts and Sciences. And each of those nominates two, and then there's a Harvard-wide, some smoke-filled room somewhere, all of these big round-bottom folks, great, powerful types, sit and choose someone. And that year it was Roger Brent and somebody else, I think. And they're basically assured of any kind of junior faculty fellowship, whether it's Pew or Searle or this or that. It doesn't really matter. They generally get what they're nominated for. Okay, when the Pew changed, they went from, I think, 40 institutions to 80 institutions. The Brigham receives an ungodly amount of NIH funds. The Brigham, this hospital receives more than most of the academic communities in the rest of the country. It's staggering. I mean, pathology has $10 million, our pathology department, and medicine has $50 million in NIH. It's a lot. So the Brigham nominated some folks, and I was one of the Brigham nominees. I got canned by Harvard, and then the Brigham people picked me up. The interesting story about this was, my chair called me. He forgot. The application came back. It sat on his desk. He called me Saturday at 3 o'clock saying, I forgot your application has to be in New Haven by Monday at 5 p.m. So I drove in, you know, slammed the whole thing together. I had to drive the thing down there, and my car broke down on the way back. It was unbelievable. Anyway, it was very valuable. Think about the total number of hours spent putting it together over the funds and fuels given in terms of dollars per hour. It was a good deal. I'm afraid I had to shoot my car, though. That never quite recovered.
Why? There must have been other possible candidates at Brigham. Why did they?
Well, who knows? That was the first year it had jumped from 40 to 80, and I get the feeling that the only reason I was nominated is that they knew, some of the folks knew who I was, and if the Brigham hadn't nominated someone because they fouled up logistically, they'd look bad, and I was available. I really, this was a last-minute deal. This was not a logical progression. This was not the kind of organized committee that they now have. It's a much bigger deal.
But how have you used those funds, in fact?
Okay, odds and ends, equipment, I would say mostly salary support. Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm most desperate for is people, and I try and recruit it. For example, this guy Freeze wants a green card. The few funds will be used to support the green card. Let's see, mostly odds and ends, I think. Things that we've run out of money on our R1. I haven't used it in any logical way. It's mostly to fill in. I have about $50,000 left, which I'm going to use to sort of as venture capital.
Did your getting the Pew have a feedback effect on people's perception of you, Brigham and
Brigham? No, not at the Brigham. They're too many good people. And there are people, you know, that are just so far above you. As I said, I'm just a maybe. I used to say I was a squire. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting a little old to be a squire. But there's people so far above you in the academics. The people, Nobel laureates. I mean, members of the National Academy all over the place. There are so many folks getting these kinds of prizes and awards that no one pays much attention. To be honest, it's almost embarrassing if you don't get them. You live just the reverse. And that's probably unfortunate. But, you know, for example, there's me, Charlie Sirhan, and Jim Anderson. I mean, and all these things come up here and there, and there are plenty of people who, what's his name, the guy with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, is 40, he was elected in the National Academy of Sciences. Like, you know, the Pew is nice, but there are things that are quite high, and people have won the Nobel Prize in Boston. And, you know, people don't really care about the Pew. I mean, enough junior faculty positions that people that are doing interesting things. We appreciate it, don't. But you just have to appreciate that there are a lot of very good people, and all of whom are requiring this or that. And, you know, even in our department, we have two marquee people, Bevilacqua, myself. Bill Muller was also in the same division, and it holds both a Pew and a RJR Nabisco. I mean, it's great. I come here and I see all my friends. It's fantastic. It's become a little incestuous, but they're good people.
In terms of... can you talk a little bit about two different things? One is your research agenda, and the other is your career agenda.
Okay. Well, all right. Research agenda, I would say, could best be described as delineating endothelial transcriptional control mechanisms. We've been trying to define what makes an endothelial cell an endothelial cell. Are there lineage-specific gene products that determine a cell to become an endothelial cell, the same way, for example, myodine determines that a skeletal muscle cell becomes a skeletal muscle cell. We're also interested in the tissue-specific as well as ubiquitous factors involved in the regulation of important endothelial genes, growth factor genes, cell surface adhesion molecule genes, understanding what role those factors play in pathologic responses that the endothelial cell might be involved in. Basically apply the tools of molecular biology to the endothelial cell. Okay, I'm not, I could give you a more detailed summary, but that's pretty much it. In terms of career agenda, I would say I would like to be productive, to do interesting things. There is a movement in the lab into developmental molecular biology. We began by looking at expression of growth factor genes in developing human embryos, and we're very interested in the mechanisms by which developmental malformations occur. With two GYN postdocs in the lab, this is all unfunded. In fact, some of the Pew funds are used to support these kinds of things. We're trying to understand why we have two arms and two legs, and what happens when we don't. And we're hoping that we can tie together growth factor gene expression and the transcriptional control of some of the so-called helix turn helix or helix loop helix DNA binding proteins. Put simply, these DNA binding proteins will tell a cell where it is, and the growth factor genes will tell it to move or to divide. And we're hoping that if we can understand that process, we'll have some idea why cells move anomalously and generate a child without an arm, for example, or other larger malformations. The nice thing about being on the autopsy service is you see a lot of dysmorphic, you see a lot of pathology in general. You see a lot of, the brain does 10,000 deliveries a year and lots of things don't go right. So we see a lot of dysmorphic events. And we're in a unique situation to combine the tools of molecular biology to study normal as well as abnormal development. That's all unfunded. I don't think I could get it funded yet. But we're very excited by that. In fact, one of the guys coming to the lab, Andy Niche, will pursue just that. And two of the guys, part-time, Ray Redline, who was writing a paper, I don't know whether it's on there, maybe at the very end, describing a homeobox gene. And Art Mendoza basically had an abstract describing expression of PDGF in human embryos. All of that is kind of an undercurrent. That's not what we're funded to do. That's not where our real strength is, but it's something that I'm intellectually excited about. Okay, long term, as I said, I want to be chairman. I think it's possible there are a couple of precedents where people can run departments, maintain good clinical services, and still run first-rate research labs.
Why do you want to do all those things?
I enjoy it. There's nothing I like more than being involved with interesting ideas. It is an obsession. It is a level of intensity that I like. As Catran put it, he wants residents who would rather write papers than go home and sleep with their wives. And that's generally my philosophy. He actually said that in a meeting. I couldn't believe it. But it basically sums up the philosophy. Women come and go. But the ideas are there. And you know, 20 years ago, we were thinking about some of the same processes. It's really funny to look at some of these older folks that you thought about, Harvey Lovish, for example, been around a while, and you read their textbooks, and you see how the field evolves. And that contribution is substantial, and I think is invaluable. We're at the right place with the right training to make a major difference in terms of intellectual history from the latter part of the 20th century. And I find that to everything else is secondary.
The way you just formulated it sounds like a very masculine grouping.
Science is a very masculine kind of job. The big people are very aggressive. And there are people who I tell you stories about, but I think then I would be treading on liberties that I really shouldn't take. But that's not to say that there aren't good female scientists. There are. There are some in Boston that are really superb. And when they're at that level, there are colleagues, there is no question. When they have that same intensity, science is an equal opportunity. When you do it right, what I don't like is when it's not done right. I think women have a very difficult job today, trying to maintain domestic harmony, trying to have a family. it is a tremendous burden. And the women that I know who are very smart, smarter than I am, are having a tough time trying to do both. And I would say that is probably the greatest, one of the greatest challenges to pull that off well that I can think of.
Quite a number of female Pew scholars now. Are they running as strongly as the men? Can you?
Well, you ask yourself, how many people are world-class scientists? How many people have a national reputation? And if you think of some, everyone has their own prejudice. But you do have some women. Pamela Bruckner, for example, is a nationally known person. But everyone goes through ups and downs. This is a very difficult time for most people. They're trying to make decisions about their personal life. They're trying to make decisions about how they're going to balance their careers with their family life. Some of that, I think, depends on where you are and what is demanded of you by circumstances that are outside of your control. But it's difficult. Mark Davis, for example, Frank Constantini, for example, these are people who were recognized pretty much throughout the scientific community for contributions. Who have been in the Pew program. Mike Benoit is another who is well established. I'm trying to think of people who I've read in Science Times. That's more general. If you've been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or in the Science Times, you've made it. I think those guys classify. I'm trying to think of people in the London Times. That's also a good one too. If you've made it to the London Times, you're definitely doing well. So I think that's really a point-by-point or case-by-case situation. And when a woman is not doing well, my first question is why. And usually she's taken some time to have a family, and there's just no way. You know, I've done pediatrics. I mean, there's just no way you can maintain the same kind of intensity and still take care of the kid. And then my colleagues that are successful are A, very smart, and B, they have money. Because usually they have living help. They have a spouse who is making a lot of money, and that kind of support, financial as well as just the day-to-day handling of kids, allows them to spend the time necessary to really maintain themselves there. But the people that try and do it alone, you know, normal moms trying to make to keep their kid in daycare, it just is tough. It's tough.
You yourself are still putting in a very large number of hours, isn't
that? Right. Yeah, I'm crazy. There's no question. I don't think most people wouldn't do what I do, but I it's pragmatic in a sense. I live on the south shore of Boston in a very lovely seacoast town. To beat the traffic, I come in very early, and it gives me a couple of hours before the troops roll in, and I stay late, both pragmatically because they're there as well as to miss the traffic.
Do you expect to still be crazy in 10 years' time?
If the science is good, I'd get depressed. The question is, am I going to be... I've remarried since then, and am I going to go through yet another spouse?
I don't know. This is just a second
marriage. This is second, yeah. Which is marginal. There is a price one has to pay for all of this, and I would say that may be part of it. Plus, I don't know about you, I tend to be much more productive when I am hungry, when I am less happy.
Do you think what you're seeing in your own life, you think that really has its analogues pretty much in the other Pew scholars and the rest of the...
No, we were actually talking about that. There are people who really are trying to maintain some sense of normalcy, especially the women. You know, it's very clear that they are trying to balance their lives. And you can sit back and look, and you know the science is suffering for it. But that's fine. There has to be some moderation. I would say it's very reasonable. As a department chairman, I have to be careful that I cannot let my own feelings. You have to encourage stability. The last thing you want is a bunch of people who aren't stable. And you have to be very supportive of family structures, because most people do very well in that kind of thing. And you need that to run a political department. I think that's true here. Most people But not all. Most people tend to do better when they're supported, when their family life is intact. But it is hard. It is hard. They feel stressed because they see some of us who are still crazy. They have my postdocs and the more senior people have all gotten beyond that. Or they have had traditional marriages where they haven't had to worry about what the woman is going to do.
Let's go to a different area, if we may, and it's to do with the impact of technology, instrumentation, big science, and all that sort of stuff. Can you?
Okay.
Is everything changing or what?
Oh yeah. There's no question. The rich get richer. The big groups move faster. Companies are in areas where they've determined to go, are like armies. Once you get an army moving in the right direction, they'll just step over anything. The trick is to know where the army's going, either get there before they do, or to stay out of their way. By armies, I mean big laboratories. Senior investigators at the Hughes Institute or members of the National Academy of Sciences. People with more than 10 postdoctoral fellows, or that many-ish postgraduate students, are big labs. With budgets of millions of dollars a year. You don't want to compete with them. And because of their productivity, it's easier for them to get additional funds, revenues. Okay, technology, I would say, has made our job, well, it's changed the level of question that we can ask, but it certainly has been important. I'm not someone who's dependent on instrumentation. I don't need a mass spec like Charlie Sirhan, for example. I don't need a fax analyzer to sort fluorescent labeled cells. The kind of DNA sequence technology that's been developed, even since I was doing the business, has made it easier, but is still not automated to the point where it negates the value of cloning genes. Okay, and that's kind of the next step. A lot of us will begin to. Well, if the genome were sequenced, we'd be asking different questions than the questions that we're currently employed to pursue.
Does that project make sense?
I'm a tremendous supporter of that. The sequence information will be absolutely incredibly useful. I'd love to see the funds come from other sources besides NIH. You don't want to deprive people of one-on-one funds to support this. This is an industrial kind of application, and it's a technology project, which I think is proceeding along the right directions to obtain basically a map, and then refine the map, and then as the sequence technology develops, to do bits and pieces of it. I actually thought at one point about writing a grant to the Human Genome Project because of our interest in some of these developmental control genes, which are generally clustered, but having published many thousands of nucleotides, I'm obviously very supportive of the acquisition of sequence data. So I'm definitely a biased observer.
Mm-hmm. I'll turn it over now.